Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have Arthur Brooks, who is the president of the American Enterprise Institute. He has been there since January 1st, 2009.
Well done.
And before that, he was a professor at Syracuse University. He spent a short time at Georgia State.
3 years.
In my Atlanta. Where did you live in Atlanta?
I lived in Druid Hills.
Okay. Okay, right near Emory.
Yeah.
So I was in Inman Park for a while. Then moved over to close to Emory. Before that, he was a professional musician, a French horn player in different orchestras, including Barcelona.
That's right.
Some interesting passages about that experience. We might get to. His books include "Who Really Cares: The Surprising Truth About Compassionate Conservatism." That's 2006. I remember when that came out. That did make quite a splash. It changed my career.
Permanently, actually. I was living a happy, professorial, relatively obscure
Life was calm, focused, life was sweet,
and I wrote a book that had tables and graphs and lots of math, and for some reason hit the news cycle in just the right way, and President Bush called, and I went on Rush Limbaugh's radio program, and things have never been the same.
Wow. You followed that up with a study entitled "Gross National Happiness: Why Happiness Matters for America and How We Can Get More of It," 2008. Those works slide neatly into today's topic, which is a book that you have just issued called "Love Your Enemies: How Decent People Can Save America from the Culture of Contempt." Arthur, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be on the First Things podcast. Congratulations on doing this.
Oh, well, thank you. I should say you're finishing your term as president here at the American Enterprise Institute, moving to
Harvard University starting July 1st, 2019. So I'm going back to academia, and I'll be in a joint appointment between the Harvard Kennedy School and the Harvard Business School, teaching leadership topics in a class at the business school and happiness, of all things.
Well, and happiness is that's sort of your social science expertise.
That's my beat. Right. Love and happiness are my beat.
Yeah. That's a nice beat to have.
Pretty nice beat.
What about hate?
Yeah, I know. It's like when you do love and happiness, you never get picketed. At least not yet.
Well, look, who would want to picket someone who wants happiness?
Exactly. Well, it's a bad look. It's like we hate the love guy. I mean, it's just,
That's true.
Not the narrative you're looking for.
So, and at Harvard, will you continue some social science projects?
Absolutely. I'm actually going back into pure creative work. So the past 10 years at AEI as president, I've been running a major institution.
Right.
Basically, my job for the past 10 years has been to help raise $50 million a year and give 175 speeches. It's like, running for the Senate and never getting elected.
And you're a regular at the Washington Post.
Yeah, I'm
at
Washington Post.
Pretty regular at the New York Times.
I was doing once a month for the New York Times for 4 years, and I've gone over and become an actual columnist at the Washington Post. I'll be increasing the frequency of the column. I'm talking about a television show on the science and art of happiness. I'll be working on new book projects. I have a podcast called The Arthur Brooks Show. There's a lot of creative work. And what I plan to not do over the next year or two is management.
I thought you were going to say not do – what you're not going to do is the 2020 election.
I'm not going to do the 2020 election, but that sort of goes without saying. The key thing is that I've been doing the past 10 years is running this institution, and that's been great, an incredible privilege. But, through the process of discernment, I figured out that it's time to get back into teaching and creative life.
Well, I was around AEI when I worked at the National Endowment for the Arts for a few years in 2003 to 2005.
Under Bill Ivey?
Dana Gioia.
Yeah.
And was up here a lot at gatherings, especially Rick Hess, he was doing with public education, primary and secondary education. And I found it ideal because here you had a genuine, an intellectual climate and a semi-academic climate as well, but it was about ideas, it was about intelligence, actionable intelligence. And when I would see panels that AEI would host, you'd bring in all different kinds of people to discuss different subjects. And I'll be honest, coming out of humanities departments in academia and going to the Modern Language Association convention and conferences and things like that, I found it an extraordinarily intellectual relief because the conversation was so open.
Yeah, no, it's a beautiful place. AEI is dedicated to all different points of view. We have a philosophical bent. But it's not a political one. The two things that we believe in that we hire on are a belief in the equality of human dignity, the radical equality of human dignity, and the not the perfectibility of the human person, of course, but the limitlessness of human potential. And so whether we're doing foreign policy or education policy or health or certainly economic policy, we're looking for people who believe these things. But then they have the rigor. They have the desire to be right. And we don't have any corporate positions, meaning that scholars get to say whatever the data tell them, you know, whatever actually
follow
comes
the evidence.
Out of them. Exactly right. And then we have a policy of having a competition of ideas, because competition is so beneficial when it's based on morality and obviously bounded by some rules. And so we make sure that we have no panels that don't have opposing points of view. And that's, I'm glad to hear that that's what you found. That's what drew me to AEI. I find this the most open, free, and really a very intellectually virtuous intellectual environment that I've ever been in.
It was. I mean, you know, you have a panel, everyone believes the same thing. What a bore.
Yeah, terrible. And that's exactly kind of what's wrong in the American debate today, is that everybody is siloing themselves. And the reason I wrote Love Your Enemies was precisely because we need to get out of our caves a little bit more. Life is just not very interesting when you don't, but also we move away from the competition of ideas, and that leads to mediocrity and stagnation, which is exactly what I think we're finding in America today.
Well, let's get to the book. Let's get to the subtitle. What is the culture of contempt? Yeah. Why call it the culture of contempt?
The problem, well, contempt is a problem every place. The trouble is that it's sort of taken over the groundwater, I think, in American culture today. And I talk about that an awful lot in the book, how people have gotten into the habit of speaking to those with whom they disagree with eye-rolling, disgust, disdain, sarcasm. And we have a million ways of ascertaining when somebody's treating us with contempt. But what we all do when we're treated with contempt is we perceive an enemy. And that's taken ideological differences in this country and turned them into animus, unbridgeable gaps. And that's, as they say in baseball, an unforced error. It makes it impossible for us to make progress as a society, to understand each other and to fulfill that ultimate commandment of loving our neighbors as ourselves.
You make a nice distinction drawing on some social science, previous social findings between the difference between anger and contempt. And what strikes me from what you just said is to be an object of anger is quite different from being an object of contempt. And the contempt one is it's much more deeply damaging than when someone's angry at you.
For sure. You know, I've been married for almost 30 years, and I've been the object of anger a lot of times. Thank God I've never been the object of contempt. Contempt is actually the number one reason that people get divorced from one another. And they get into a habit of it. Contempt denotes real hatred. And most married couples, even when they're on the rocks, they don't hate each other. They still love each other. But when they get into a habit of treating each other with contempt, that's what, according to the great expert in marital reconciliation named John Gottman, I interviewed him for this book, mm-hmm. and he says that that's the number one predictor of divorce. He can predict with 94% accuracy if a couple will be divorced within 3 years by looking for signs, overt signs of contempt, the eye rolling, the sarcasm, the derision. Mm-hmm. And so when you get into that habit, you find that you will virtue signal to your own side. You'll lock down your base, but you'll, number one, you'll persuade no one. And if you want to be in the ideas business, then persuasion should be key. You will be unpersuadable, which is a complete lack of humility. It will make you unhappy when you treat other people with contempt. You'll make other people unhappy. And there's 0% chance you'll be part of the greater unity that we need as a nation. So the big offer that I have in this book, and this, by the way, this is a self-improvement book. This is not an institutions book, which is the kind of thing I ordinarily write. I mean, this is a roadmap for me to be the kind of man I want to be.
No, it's very engaging. It's very personable as well. It's very direct in that way. Yeah.
I use the second person in this. I say you, and I talk about me. I mean, because in truth, institutional reform isn't good enough, where what we need is personal revolution. And look, I'm a Catholic, and the secret to the success of the Catholic faith is not the institution of the Vatican. On the contrary, Catholicism is pretty successful despite the Vatican, mm-hmm. in my view. It's the call to personal revolution and the radical change that's enacted in inside each one of us, and the deep satisfaction, the cosmic metaphysical satisfaction that comes when that revolution is undertaken. And, you know, that there's a simulacrum for that that we can get in all the areas of our lives. And so, you know, in reflecting on what's wrong with our country today, I said, look, it's not good enough for me to write a book about politics or capitalism or whatever. I have to write about how Arthur Brooks's heart needs to be different and offer that up to readers with humility and affection.
And one thing you note about contempt, and especially in our political, the public square, is that whatever satisfactions contempt provides, momentary satisfactions, you quote, say, this is not really what we want.
Yeah, it's funny.
Contempt doesn't make people happy.
Yeah. No, it doesn't give deep satisfaction in the same way that cigarettes don't give deep satisfaction. And it's a non-trivial comparison. When people treat others with contempt, they get a small reward, a reward of being right, a reward of giving somebody a zinger. And there's a neurological phenomenon, which is, there's a neurotransmitter called dopamine. Practically everybody knows about that today. And all habits have dopamine in common, whether they're, you know, you're chemically juicing it with cigarettes or alcohol or dangerous drugs, or whether you're doing it through your behavior, through gambling or sex, or in this case, treating other people with contempt, you get a tiny little reward. The problem is that that's addictive. And addictive behavior gives you a short-term reward with a long-term penalty. And the penalty is much, much, much higher, but we discount that in sort of this hyperbolic way where you want the short-term payoff so much. And people don't really, they can't quite understand their behavior. And the reason is because you're not processing that dissonance through your prefrontal cortex, the part of your brain that governs your conscious behavior. It goes through a part of your brain called the nucleus accumbens, which is a very ancient part of the brain, about the size of the end of your pinky finger, deep in your brain, evolved more than a million years ago. And that's what governs rewards, but it's not conscious. And so when you get into a pattern of talking to your wife with contempt because she said something contemptuous to you, you're being governed by your emotions. You're not the governor of your emotions. And that means that your nucleus accumbens is in charge. You're getting a little dopamine hit. You're probably doing something that's damaging your relationships and your love, the life in your life in the long run, and you need to change that. And what I try to do in this book over a couple hundred pages is give people what I think is the roadmap, which I believe is my own roadmap for turning my back on contempt and trying to be a greater force for love and reconciliation.
Well, you give a little anecdote how the alternative to contempt, especially when you feel you are assailed in some way, that someone's heaping scorn on you, you want to react with bigger, better scorn.
Mm-hmm.
And that you almost stumbled into a different approach. And this was an email you received when your book hit big time. You got a lot of responses, and you said one response came in that was, I think, 5,000 words.
Yeah, yeah.
Email.
Yeah.
What happened there?
So this is 2006, the first book that you mentioned called Who Really Cares? And it was a very academic book that I had written while I was still teaching at Syracuse about who gives to charity, religious people, secular people, conservative people, liberal people, secular people, religious people. I mean, I already said that. I meant poor people, rich people, whatever. And everything that we thought we knew about charity turns out to be wrong, according to the data. And so I published the book and kind of waited for the phone to not ring, because that's typically what would happen when I wrote books, is no phone ringing. I'd written a bunch of books before that. They were very boring and obscure. But it did hit, and I started getting email, among other things, from hundreds of people I'd never met, which is what happens when your book is selling a lot. And I got an email from a guy in Texas, I remember, one afternoon, saying, "Dear Professor Brooks, you are a right-wing fraud." Which is a tricky way to start
email.
That's
the beginning, okay.
Yeah, that's the beginning. And so, you know,
But you kept reading.
Because I'm a good sport, and I thought that was the right thing to do. And I noticed the thing was like 5,000 words long. It took me 20 minutes to read. And for some reason, I became conscious of my emotions. I was reading through it. You know, 15 minutes in, this guy was going through chapter and verse, everything in my book, every detail.
And
I mean,
your first response is, you are wrong, and I'm not going to, you're an idiot.
Yeah, but I was, but I realized that there was this surge of feeling that it was the strangest thing. I was gratitude. I thought to myself, this guy read my book.
He read.
I mean, it's like nobody reads my books. I mean, my family doesn't read my books. They're so boring. And so I decided, you know, I got nothing to lose. And so I wrote back to him. I'm never going to see this guy. You're so-and-so. I know you hated my book and think I'm a right-wing stooge and it's terrible and I'm terrible and everything's terrible. But you took a lot of time to read that thing. It took me 2 years to write. I put my whole heart into it. And so I got to tell you, I mean, I just got to tell you, I'm actually really grateful. Thank you. And it was heartfelt. Mm-hmm. And 15 minutes later, I get an email back from him. And when it pops up on my email, I'm very apprehensive. You know, maybe he wants to kill me now or something. I don't know. And I open it up and it says, "Dear Professor Brooks, next time you're in Dallas, give me a call if you want to get some dinner."
He was remarkably surprised.
He was shocked.
You took him seriously.
Yeah. And not only that, I didn't kid myself that suddenly the guy likes my book, but he realized he suddenly liked me.
Yeah.
And that's the power. You know, see, this is the thing. People think that if we're, you know, repair this country, we have to agree. And the only way we're going to agree is by beating each other somehow into agreement, which has never happened in human history. Nobody in the history of mankind has been insulted into agreement. Hate, as Martin Luther King always used to say, is self-defeating. You cannot redeem anyone with hate. And by the way, we don't even have to like each other. But the point is we have to treat each other with love because that's the only chance that we've got to disagree productively and to make progress.
I think John Lewis said, a Georgia congressman who was young guy in the civil rights movement, I think he once said, "I realized that if I continued to hate, it would kill me."
Yeah.
His own hate would tear him up.
It would. And it's highly impractical in this way too. I mean, people will push back on this book. I mean, love your enemies. It sounds like, you know, I'm just some sort of summer love radical or something. And, yeah. and they'll say, well, you know, look, there are a lot of people who deserve my contempt. These are people who they want to take my faith away. They want to take, some people think that, you know, they're racists that want to come kill me, mm-hmm. you know, whatever. And inside the United States, thank God, most of that's hyperbolic. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's most of that is inaccurate, mm-hmm. notwithstanding the really strong language that we've got in very radical circles on the right and left. Most of it's not true. But to the extent that there are people who believe those things, you know, the question is, what about people who do deserve my contempt? And the witness of Jesus Christ was always, there are ideas worthy of contempt, but not people worthy of contempt. And if we can't make a distinction between ideas and people, woe be unto us. You know, when I'll ask people that say that very strongly, I'll say, okay, let's take somebody that, you know, a real Nazi, a real Stalinist, you know, somebody who really would, if they could, you think, jail you for your Catholic faith. There's very few people like this, but let's just say you can find somebody like this in the dark recesses of Twitter. What's your goal in debating that person? Would you really want to jail that person? Well, no, of course not. Do you want to go into their house at night and hurt them if you could? No. What kind of person do you think I am? Would you take away their vote? No. Well, then what's your goal? And the answer is to convince them and have them think differently. So, well, how's the hate working out for you, man?
Yeah.
How's the hate working for you? Because let me tell you, it's you will redeem zero people and you won't be persuasive and you've just defeated yourself.
Right. You know, I'm gonna give a parallel story. I wrote this book several years ago about called The Dumbest Generation, about young digital age and young kids, and that they're all so caught up in social media and the internet that it's making them stupid, and it was polemical. I got a lot of emails, hundreds and hundreds of emails. I still get them sometimes. Young kids, sometimes 4-letter words or 12-letter words, and right off the bat, I decided, well, I'm a teacher. These are 18-year-olds. And I've just insulted 93 million Americans with this book. So I have to respond to each one.
Yeah.
And I learned I got lucky because I responded solely on substance. And a few times I had to say, you know, you got me on that one. I overplayed that point. The minute they heard a response that took what they said seriously, or actually took them as a respondent, the return was completely different.
Totally.
Exactly what you thought. And I learned so much of the anger, the contempt, the bluster, it's not really, once you engage, that just goes away.
It does, because you engage as a person and you have effectively separated yourself from your own ideas. And man, we are people. We're not just a bundle of opinions, and yet that's how we're portrayed, particularly with social media, which is an inherently dehumanizing experience. The other thing that's worth keeping in mind is that, you know, we put a huge premium on being persuasive. And I've talked about, you know, how nice it is to be persuasive, which is why we shouldn't hate. But being persuasive is, in sort of the culture war, that could be very deeply implicated in pride. You know, I want to be persuasive because I'm, you know, motivated by my pride in doing so. The greater satisfactions in life come from the heavenly virtues, not the deadly sins. And the parallel, the opposite heavenly virtue from pride, of course, is humility. To be persuasive is great, but to be persuadable is deeply, deeply satisfying. And when you love your enemies, what you're largely doing is you're destroying the illusion that somebody was your enemy. When Abraham Lincoln said that I destroy my enemy when I make him my friend, he wasn't saying I'm going to destroy the person. He was destroying the illusion of the enemy, which is a very Buddhist concept in its way. But it's Christ-like too, because that's obviously what he's talking about in Matthew 5:44. But in doing that, when you destroy the illusion that somebody is your enemy, then you can listen to that person. And almost always people have something that they can teach you. Yeah. And when you say, good point, and you actually mean it, it will change the other person's heart. But the deep satisfaction that enters yours comes from the humility itself.
And Arthur, it doesn't take much for them just to hear, you know, I think you're right on that. Just one small
you could
piece
rock somebody's world
of acknowledgement.
Because they won't have ever heard it.
That's the thing. How many people in America today, because they're so siloed, never hear the other side grant them any generosity? Anyone, any partner, any disagreement, they just sort of assume it's all or nothing.
Totally.
Here.
If I don't get 100% of what I think, then that effectively I've gotten zero. And that's how our political discourse works. But it's also a problem that people have understanding the nature of strength and weakness. I can't, if I show anything less than 100% confidence in my own opinions, and I don't fight to the death on every minor point, I've displayed weakness.
You're weak.
And the weakness is the ultimate sin. It's actually wrong. In my weakness, I find my strength. This is St. Paul, and it was more than rhetoric. In point of fact, understanding the weakness in your own argument is the strength not only of your character, but it strengthens, it steelmans your own arguments.
And Arthur, I'm sure you've learned from all your lectures, the greatest, one of the great weapons you have to have as a public speaker is to be able to laugh at yourself. You're up on stage, you mispronounce a word, you make a mistake, you just laugh at yourself and everyone just laughs with you and you move on.
Yeah, nobody likes people who take themselves too seriously. Yeah. And so being self-deprecating, I mean, it can be corny and hackneyed, but it's also really important because we have to recognize that none of us has an exclusive hold on truth. We can learn things from other people, and we deserve to have more love in our lives. So if you want to be more persuadable because it's satisfying, you want to be more persuasive because you think that you have something to share with others, you want to be a happier person, you want other people to be happier because you are your brother's keeper, and you think the country's too divided and like to bring it back together, there's one way to do it, and that's love your enemies.
We could add, you mentioned gratitude a moment ago. Gratitude is something of an expression of humility. As well.
Yeah.
I'm grateful for this. And it's almost like the same thing with love. Who's going to respond poorly to you when you express gratitude?
You know, some will, you know, they'll kick you when you, but that's that little mortification has its own strength as well. You know, what we can guarantee is that when you express love in the face of hate, when you express warm-heartedness in the face of contempt, when you do not answer hatred with hatred, that you will change your own heart. Mm. And maybe you'll change somebody else's heart as well, but you've lost nothing from the exchange. I mean, and this is one of the things that politicians will often tell me, because I've talked about this a lot up on the Hill. I have the great luck of being in a job where I do communications training for members of Congress regularly. And I'll say, try this. And they'll, when they concede points, even in debates, people see that as strength. They think that people are going to see that as weakness. And
you're secure.
It's like, you're right. I shouldn't have said it in that way, because in so doing, I actually created the wrong impression. That's good. That's a great, and it's satisfying to the audience to actually see somebody who is strong enough to be able to do that, but convicted.
Right. You mentioned anonymity a while ago. And you have some good pages on anonymity in Love Your Enemies. What's wrong with anonymity at the present time?
Yeah.
Right.
No, and anonymity through most of time. I mean, there are times when you write the Federalist Papers, and it's probably good to do that under an assumed name such that you can foment the American Revolution or something. But Twitter is not the Federalist Papers, last time I checked. And anonymity is, in our culture, is largely a metastatic phenomenon. Why? Because it dehumanizes us when we are anonymous and we are interacting with somebody who is purposively less than human when we interact with anonymous people. You know, love can only occur between two people, two human people. That's the only way love. You can't love a robot. You can't love an idea. You can't love a chair. I mean, you can say, I love my car, but you don't actually love your car. Mm-hmm. You can only love, I mean, Mark and Arthur can share the bonds of friendship. And if we do it right, we know each other for a long time, it'll be a perfect Aristotelian friendship. That's a beautiful thing. But if it turns out that Mark's a cyborg, it's not the same. It doesn't work that way. Well, we're basically asymmetrically dealing with each other when there's anonymity. We've dehumanized ourselves and others. And in so doing, we've prevented the ability of actual love from occurring. That's problematic. So one of the things that I recommend in the book is, number one, really rationing social media, because social media is, it turns out, I mean, there's more and more data that show clearly that every hour you spend on social media is an hour you will be less happy as a person.
Let me read one section, just also to give the readers the flavor of the book. You're talking here about online anonymity. You say the evidence on online anonymity is alarming, although it could have its practical uses. When you're on a first date, everyone out there, when you're on a first date, slip in the question, do you have an anonymous Twitter account? If the person says yes, say no to a second date.
You continue.
Well, part of that's based on a study that shows that sociopathic behavior is accentuated in people that have those tendencies, right, by anonymity. And so, and people who enjoy anonymity and especially enjoy trolling are the people that are most sociopathic.
Right.
And you know,
low empathy.
Yeah, the low empathy, capacity. Machiavellianism, and you know, high narcissism. And low levels of sympathy toward the pain of others. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this dark suite of characteristics that people have. And, you know, you want to know that before that person becomes the father of your children.
I tell young people when I give talks on college campus or my own students, I say, you know, just never say anything online anonymously that you wouldn't say right in the presence of that person.
Yeah.
I mean, it's partly this question of just integrity.
Yeah, take responsibility for everything that you say. Right. You know, one of the things that we always, you know, our parents taught us and that we try to teach our kids is don't gossip. And, you know, don't gossip. Don't talk behind people's backs. Well, anonymity, even if you're talking to somebody but you're cloaking your own yourself, is a weird form of attack.
Right.
It's an attack from, you know, behind a curtain where people actually can't see. It's profoundly unfair, but it has the same characteristics as gossip.
And even listening to gossip, I include that in part of the participation.
Yeah.
And there's a great scene late in Dante's Inferno when in one of the deep circles, Dante sees two of the damned souls. They start arguing with another, and they're just back and forth, and Dante is listening, and he kind of loses his focus on other things, and he's absorbed in this quarrel until he hears Virgil's voice say, if you keep listening to those two, you and I will begin to quarrel. And I think Virgil's not just saying, I'm going to get mad at you for doing this. He's just saying, this kind of watching, backbiting, nastiness, it infects you.
Right. So Mark, this
starts getting into your soul as well.
Yeah, and so this is a really important point that you're making for a lot of people who are listening to us. And I know that there are a lot of young people who listen to this podcast that are involved in Twitter and online. And what this is saying, let me take a lesson from Dante. Let's say you don't have an anonymous Twitter handle. Let's say that you don't entertain conversations between anonymous people or Russian Twitter bots, whatever they happen to be, but you kind of enjoy the big battles on social media. You're watching the back and forth, you're watching the bitterness, and you're taking some satisfaction in it. remember Virgil's voice. Hear it in your ear. You will be dragged down. You will be dragged into it. This is a form of vice. This is a kind of pornography.
Right.
You know, when you're seeing behavior that actually shouldn't be occurring and you're enjoying it, that's prurience.
Prurient, exactly.
And
it's the word.
It's really dangerous. It's dangerous for your character. I'm not enough of a theologian to say it's dangerous for your soul, but I'm going to speculate that that is certainly the case for me.
Yeah, I mean, well, what you're exposed to, it just, well, you know, if you get exposed too much, it just starts becoming the air you breathe.
Yeah.
And it becomes, you get inured to the, so think on, you know, whatever.
It's too hard to love your enemies when you.
Whatever is lovely, whatever is true, whatever is good, you know, think on these things.
You
right?
become less interesting to a certain class of people when you do that. You're a more interesting person if the conflict is always on your lips. You know, when you're the kind of person who says, you've got something bad to say about somebody, come over here.
You just sit right next to you. Right?
Yeah.
Right.
On the other hand, you know, when I talked to John Gottman, the marriage counselor I talked about a minute ago, about, you know, his techniques for bringing couples back together. And I said, what would you recommend to people online if they want to militate, if they want to subvert the culture of contempt based on what you know about bringing couples back together? And he thought about it and he gave me this very profound piece of advice where he said, use the 5-to-1 rule. I said, what's that? The 5-to-1 rule is he makes couples before they criticize each other. Because when you're about to get divorced, all you can think of is criticism, apparently. Whereas when you're first in love, there's no criticism that comes to mind. So before you criticize your partner, you have to say 5 loving, complimentary things to your partner. You got to write them down. You got to carry a notebook around. So he says, use the 5-to-1 rule online, where if you want to say something snarky, something sarcastic, something derisive, something maybe a little contemptuous, write it down. And you got to say 5 complimentary, beautiful things first. Imagine doing that. Imagine the virtue that would spring up in your heart simply from manual. Trying to make it so. Remember, that one of the great things about being the master of yourself is remembering that action, that attitude follows action, that you will feel the things that you simulate. The Dalai Lama one time gave me this advice, and he's all throughout this book because I've been working with him for 7 years. And the Dalai Lama gave me this advice when he said, you know what? I said, what do I do when I feel contemptuous toward other people? He said, practice warm-heartedness.
Warm-hearted.
And I said, what if I don't feel it? And he said, the Dalai Lama told me to fake it.
Fake it. Yeah. I mean, look. Prayer.
Yeah.
You pray. You do. If you don't really feel it, if you
pray anyway.
Pray anyway.
Yeah. No. It's the most amazing thing is when I talk to young Catholics and one of the things that I recommend to all Catholics, but especially young Catholics, is pray your rosary every day. It's like chemotherapy. Pray your rosary every day. It's such a powerful weapon. Mm-hmm. And you know, I've studied the meditation techniques, you know, with the Dalai Lama, but I'm not a Buddhist. I have my rosary. And so I recommend it. And they'll say, yeah, but I don't feel like my mind wanders or I feel like I'm really bored. Do it anyway.
So what?
Do it anyway.
Do it anyway.
Because that's the sacrifice. And it's the essence of the sacrifice per se. It's your boredom dying to itself.
Right. Well, and I think what you say about the Dalai Lama's point is this actually is a way of developing the meditative concentration.
Yeah.
Right? The practice can follow the practice can lead to the deeper transformation.
And even if it was a lost 25 minutes, this is not about having lower anxiety and stress. This is about mortifying yourself a little bit. This is about giving up a little bit. This is about giving up 25 minutes, even to boredom, because there is a higher calling. I mean, you're praying to Our Lady.
Exactly. On that note, thank you, Arthur Brooks. Let me mention the book, Love Your Enemies. It is How Decent People Can Save America from the Culture of Contempt.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you so much. Thanks to First Things and all of your great listeners.
Thank you.